You're listening to episode 361 of the GNU New World Order. My name's Klaatu, and this episode is ostensibly about Groth, and I guess it will be a little bit about Groth, but actually more specifically, it's going to be about PDF Mom, possibly the big saving grace of Groth. You'll find out why in a little while, and I hope I'm not being too harsh on Groth by calling PDF Mom that, or heaping too much expectation on PDF Mom. Either way, we're going to talk about that first, and then we'll get into the last bits and bobs of Groth. I don't want to spend any more episodes on Groth. I think we all get the point. But there is a lot in this package. And of course, that is what we're doing in this series right now. We're going through every single package that you get on Slackware. You might not have all these packages on your distribution if you're not running Slackware, but you have them available. Your software repository, undoubtedly. Groth, which is what we're talking about today and for the past two episodes, is most certainly on your distribution already, and that is kind of one of its main benefits, is that it is a tool chain for writing content and translating it into different formats, a couple of different formats, HTML, MAN, for MAN pages, PDF, PostScript, and probably some other DVI, I guess, others that I'm not thinking of. But first and foremost, out of all the binaries that we've discussed within Groth so far, I want to skip ahead to the middle of the end to PDF Mom. Now, PDF Mom, like Groth itself, is a little bit more than just a command. It is also a syntax, and, well, no, I guess it's not technically. Mom is the syntax. What is Mom? Well, it means my other macros, or my own macros, or if you really want to go crazy, you could say maximum overdrive macros. That's from the homepage of shafter.ca/mom. Point is that they're a set of macros for Groth. And it kind of answers the question of what would happen if someone took the engine that Groth provides and built a new car around it. That is to say, Groth is really cool because it exists by default. It has all these text processing powers, but all those weird macros, or rather, sorry, all of those weird requests and arguments, they're a little bit difficult maybe to comprehend or wrap your head around and so on. I don't know how true that is. I mean, .th for title heading and .sh for subheading and so on. It's not, I wouldn't say that it was an impossible feat to understand and to even remember those requests. That said, they're a little bit different. They're a little bit far afield from what we're used to, arguably. And so what someone has done, the creator of Mom has done, is they created an arguably simplified set of requests and placed it into a set of macros so that you can use Groth without knowing the obscure requests that under normal circumstance, you'd have to know. It's a pretty cool idea. I really like it because I love the idea of building off of someone else's work in open source. I mean, that's what open source is all about. And so the idea of taking this perfectly acceptable text processing machine mechanism and sort of remixing it and putting your own spin on that, that's just a really, really perfect open source idea to me. So how simple is this? I don't know. I feel like it's a little, you know, half a dozen of this, six of the other, whatever that expression is. I mean, it is still markup. The markup mixes style and content, which isn't necessarily, you know, sort of in this enlightened age of separating style from content, seems to not be the typical thing. You know, we tend to avoid that sort of thing. That said, it feels, you know, I mean, certainly the tags are human readable and familiar. They're arguably a lot more self-explanatory than .th, .sh, and so on. Now, I don't know all of the macros available, and so I'm going to kind of stumble through parts of this. But for instance, there is a macro called title, and Title is the macro that contains the title of your document. So for instance, if we open up an empty text document, the first thing that we would need to do is create a title for our document, and that would be .title, T-I-T-L-E, all capital, and then a space or some number of spaces, quote, my example, mom doc, close quote. And then we'll do a .author, A-U-T-H-O-R, all capital, on the next line, and again, a space or some number of spaces, and I'll put in quotes here, Clat2. And we can give it a chapter title, or a chapter number, rather. So that'll be .chapter(1). Okay, so that's the metadata. That's the document properties, as it were. After that, we can choose a template that we want to use. So the templating macro is .doctype, D-O-C-T-Y-P-E, .doctype. And in this case, it is a chapter. This is a chapter doctype. That is... That's from a collection. All of these are macros, right? So you kind of have to, if you want to find out all of the things that are available to you, you need to become familiar with the MOM set of macros, just like any other markup language that you are trying to learn. There are certain, or even a markdown language, less so in markdown ideally, but there's still syntax in markdown. So in a markup language, you need to know what tags are available to you. So for instance, in this case, knowing that there is a doctype macro means that then you would want to look up what doctypes there are available. Turns out there's a default, which is whatever, that's what you get if you don't use a doctype header at all, or a doctype macro at all. There's chapter, and then there's named, and then I think there's letter, and slides, and that looks like it's about it. Yeah, that's true. And it that particular macro controls what is printed, for instance, at the header of the page. Is it just the title of the document, or is it a chapter number, and then the title, and then the page number, and so on. So those are templates, essentially. All right, next line, we could do print style, and print style, again, it's another macro. It defines what kind of processing it will do when you send it out to another format. There's typeset, there's typewrite, and then there's single space. Typewritten is double spaced. And finally, you can control a little bit of style, which again, like I say, not sure about the idea of putting style in the source document, but I think there's an argument that keeping it in the header is sort of permissive, like that's kind of allowable, right? We could do that. We can sneak a little bit of style into a source document at the head, as long as we don't go changing it all over the place later on in the document, right? Well, we'll see about that. Well, we won't. I'm not going to get that deep into this, but you know, if I was using it on a day-to-day basis, I do wonder how that would work out if I needed to change, for instance, I don't know, the color of my chapter headings or the color of the text. Or maybe I wanted to adjust the font for just code snippets and so on. How is that done? How is that executed? Is it done within the file, or is it a template that'll get applied? Who knows? I don't know. I haven't looked at it that deeply. But once you're finished your... No, wait. Sorry. So we have to do the type style. And there's a couple of different options there. Once again, you can do... Oh, in typesetting, you can also set the page size. That's actually pretty significant, for me at least, because I don't use letter size page. I use whatever it is, A4. So under the styling, we can adjust, for instance, the size of the font. So .pt_size, we could set that to 10-point font. And for the leading, we could say .ls for leading, and we'll set that to 12 points. So there, you know, to kind of control where the letters fall on whatever is considered the baseline. And that's enough for the sample document. After that, we can just start writing. There's don't take my simple heading to mean that there's not a lot of control within the syntax of MOM, because there's quite a lot more that you can choose from. There are lots of different options here that you can adjust kerning, you can adjust the gutter of the page, the ligature, the point size. Well, we did that. And so on. So, and the page size, like I said, so there are lots of different options there, and that's fine. What we're going to do though is start typing. And so the start of my document and the end of my header is going to start with a dot start. So that's kind of setting my style to, in HTML terms, it would sort of be like the main div, or in word processors, it might be a transition from, for instance, a heading, an H1 or whatever they call it in the word processors, and then to normal text, like a body text, whatever. So I'll just do dot start, all capitals, and then I can just type in some text. So this is some sample text. I hope it comes out all right. It probably will, thanks to PDF Mom. And then I'll close that document. And now I can just run PDF Mom on this document, which is the command that we're talking about, PDF Mom. So I'm going to do PDF Mom, example.mom, that's what I called the file. And then I'm going to redirect that into mom.pdf. And that happened pretty quickly. And so I'll ocular mom.pdf. And here we go. It's kind of disappointingly single paged. Obviously, there's not a whole lot of text here, but it definitely is a chapter one. It says there's some sample text. Hope it comes out all right. Probably will, thanks to PDFmom. And all of that's on one line, of course, because as we know, Groff takes your separate lines and concatenates them pretty much into one paragraph. Now we know from Groff how we could control that, and that would be to go back into our sample file. And this time I'm going to leave all that. That'll be our introductory paragraph. And then I'm going to do a .pp for a new paragraph. And I'm just going to import some boilerplate text if I can find some. There we go. I got some boilerplate text. Bunch of boilerplate text, which I'll just separate all the blank lines. I'm going to put a .pp between. So now I've got 23 lines of text, or a couple more than that, actually. I might as well mention here that when writing a lot of text, especially in a markup or markdown language where you can afford this luxury, I put every sentence on a new line, which seems, it feels strange when you first start doing it. But it's essentially treating your text like code. Because when you feed that to Git, for instance, if you change one letter on one line, then Git can zero in exactly on that line and that one letter change, and it is a tiny little commit that you've made. Whereas if you've got a whole paragraph on one line, then to Git, that whole paragraph has changed. That's quite a lot. That's a larger commit. Now, if it's even worse and the whole page is on one line, then obviously it's a huge change. So I like to put everything on a separate line. And if you're using a markup or a markdown language, then I don't think there's any reason not to do that, because the paragraphs will be recognized by the markup language just as you'd expect. So I've just processed this with PDF Mom again and ocular mom.pdf, and now I've got a chapter one, and then I've got my first paragraph and second and the third and the fourth paragraphs, and it looks very nice. It looks very professional. It looks exactly like you'd expect from a typesetting application. I mean, it really does. It looks. This could be the output of, for instance, Pandoc or DocBook or OpenOffice or LibreOffice, whatever. It looks very, very nice. So the first paragraph is not indented, and whether that is a problem for you or not depends on what you're looking for. But if I wanted to indent it, give it that initial tab, for instance, then I could do a .pp at the beginning of, right after my start macro, and then it would indent that accordingly. Or if I want to lose those entirely, I could use, instead of the .pp request or macro, I could use the .ip request, and that wouldn't indent it at all. So if I wanted that sort of fresh, new, we don't indent paragraph look, I could mess around with that. And there's a focus here, I think. If you look at the options that you have on the Mon documentation, there is a focus on providing a rudimentary word processor experience, meaning the expectations you might have from an old school word processor is very much present here. So, for instance, if you want to force a line break, that seems like a simple task. But it's like, I mean, in a word processor, I think that would be a simple task. But in markup and markdown, a lot of times, it's all programmed not to do that. It eats white space. It collapses white space down to one, either, you know, one space or maybe one line. People get frustrated about that sometimes. They want to have more control over the style applied to their content. And there are quote-unquote right ways to do that, either in CSS or in XSL or whatever your, you know, pick your poison. And with Mon, it just provides you with a line break macro. You put that into your document, and there you've got a line break. I guess in a way, it does feel a little bit like LaTeX to me, with almost completely no experience with a text language. But from what I've seen, you can insert like arbitrary control commands in a LaTeX document. I mean, you can do that, for instance, with DocBook and XSL. You can design your own line break macro, for lack of a better term, but it is something that you have to do sort of yourself, and then you've made up this new tag, and you insert the tag into your document, and that's what you have. And it is, like I say, it's considered something that you're not supposed to do, because the style shouldn't ever intermingle with your content, and there are good reasons for that. That's not just sort of a trite, like, this is the way we do things. I mean, there really are very good reasons to do that, and if you've ever maintained large sets of documentation, you'll know those reasons. You'll be familiar with, oh, I remember that one time I had to grep through an entire source, you know, an entire tree of source files, trying to find this combination of really poor choices. And because they didn't do it consistently, sometimes the order was width and then foreground color, and then other times it was foreground color and then width, and other times it was single quotes around the style, and other times it was double quotes, and so on. So you'll know the problem that can introduce, and you'll know that when you export to, for instance, I don't know, EPUB versus PDF, you have a different set of concerns over style. So there's a good reason for separating that content out from the style. That said, not everyone is doing that kind of documentation. And so if you find yourself maybe in between, well, I want to maintain my source as essentially code, but I'm not going to sign up for this sort of super formalized separating content from style and learning a whole new complex build system and so on, Mom might be something to look at. I mean, it might not be. There's lots of other options out there. But Mom exists. The back end is Groff, and therefore the back end exists on your system. I'm almost sure of it. If it's a Linux system, I mean, there's the man pages that you already have access to more than likely. So there's some amount of Groff on your system already, meaning that you can probably process the Mon set of macros. And I guess more to the point of this episode, that is what PDF Mon is. So if we have this sample Mon document, running it through PDF Mon generates the PDF. It looks very attractive. It looks very professional. It's all from a source, from a single source, and it's from a source that you can submit to Git and track with Git, and you can run diffs against, or make diff graph or whatever. You can do all those sorts of things, but you end up with this really, really attractive PDF document. That's PDF Mon. Let's have some coffee. Okay, coffee has been acquired, and it's time to finish up the Groff overview. This is the third episode on Groff, so I want to get through the rest of it rather quickly, which means, unfortunately, we're going to bypass a couple of them. I mean, we're not going to pass them by completely, but we're not going to talk about them in depth, because truly, once you get the hang of a couple of different commands, then it all starts to look the same. But first, so in the previous episode, we left off with grog, which was grof guess. It told you what grof command it thought you should run, given some specific input file. That's useful. Next up is grolbp and grolj4. These are front or backends, rather, for grof output to specific devices. So the grolbp goes out to some kind of Canon LBP model laser printer, and grolj4 goes out to, I think, an HP LaserJet 4 or something like that. I don't know whether those backends are necessary, because those printers specifically don't read PostScript. Maybe they have some kind of other language that they process. I'm not sure, but those are the two that exist for whatever reason, and I don't want to talk about them because they're not that useful. The next one after that is grolpdf and grolps, and these are front ends for grof to help you avoid the laborious task of typing in -T PDF or -T PS. I'm really not too sure why these things exist, because, I mean, really, you can do, as far as I can tell, they don't do anything aside from what grof -T PDF does, really. So I'm not exactly sure what the advantage of having these little front ends, why they're here. One thing might be because of these front ends, you get new options. So for instance, -P for paper size, -Y for foundry, -for font house, something else to define what PDF format, compatibility format to account for, and so on. So maybe that's the reason. Okay, so after that, there is a grotty, grotty. This is a grof driver for typewriter-like devices. This is to send grof to a device that is ASCII, well, not necessarily ASCII, but that is text-based. So for instance, -T ASCII, -T UTF-8, -T Latin-1, -T whatever other encoding format happens to be on your system. So that's the grotty driver, or rather front end. And again, you can find what drivers your system happens to have installed by looking in user share grof, and then the version of whatever you have installed, and then /font will show you all the different fonts of, or rather all the different devices available that, you know, by nature contain different font references. So, for instance, I see here DevASCII, I see DevHTML, that's a useful one, DevLBP, DevLJ4, we know that exists because we have the LBP and the LJ4 devices, DevDVI, which we talked about, I think, last time, GrowDVI, DevUTF-8, and so on. So you can kind of get a feel for your targets through looking at user share grof version fonts. Next in the list is GXDITView, GXDITView. This is a strange one. I can't get it to work. That's the short answer. The longer answer is that GXDITView is kind of an X-Man. If you've ever seen, I think it was called X-Man, just a really basic X11, X11 application that displays man pages so that you can kind of scroll through in a graphical interface. Doesn't seem that big of a deal to me. I never really bothered using external viewers for man pages. I know that Conqueror could do it as well. I don't see a point. I think that they're fine in the terminal, so I don't really tend to mess around with those. But that's what apparently GXDITView is, except that it doesn't seem to work. So the man page for GXDITView doesn't give me any sample commands. It gives me, strangely, sample grof commands, but not the command to actually make this application work. Now, if I do the sort of obvious gxditview and then point it at a Grof file or a man page in this case, which I happen to have ls.1. I've just zcatted that from user share user man one ls.1.gz and then zcat that here to ls1. Gxedit view ls.1, it opens to a blank window. There's no text here. If I left click, there's a menu, but I can't seem to click on any of the selections, so I'm not really sure what the heck is going on there. Interestingly, I can get this thing to show me text if I use this grof command that the gxedit view gives me, which, again, I don't know why there's a command that then points you to a different command. So if I do a zcat user man 1 ls1.gz, for instance, and then type that to grof dash capital T x100-12-man-rs12, then I get my fancy graphical window with the man page all formatted correctly. I can't seem to do any mouse interactions with it, but I can arrow through it. And so that's kind of as far as I've gotten with this one, and it's really quite puzzling to me. I'm not sure what the point is, and certainly I wouldn't want to go to all that trouble just to view a man page. I would think that just typing in man ls would be the quicker and easier way. So that one puzzles me a lot. I'm not really sure what that's all about. HPF to dit is a command that I'm not going to bother with, but it does exist. HPF to dit is a font description file. You will remember this from the XPM to HPF or something like that. So these are it's manipulating font descriptions for use with Grof. And like I said a couple episodes ago, I don't really see the reason we would need that in the modern age. Next up is a couple of bibliography commands, and these are interesting in theory and turned out to be a little bit underwhelming in practice. But there are three or four, depends on how you look at it, bibliography commands. There's indexbib, lookbib, and lookbib. That's lkbib and lookbib. And the theory, oh, and refer, refer, refer. And the theory here is that you should be able to apparently make citations, like in a bibliography, and run it through indexbib and generate this kind of index file of all the books that you have available to reference in whatever you're working on. Now, I haven't done a bibliography in ages. I mean, I did them in school, probably. I probably was required to do that for some rudimentary English composition class, but I haven't looked at a bibliography, or rather, I haven't had to do a bibliography since. So I'm not too clear on sort of the workflow here, but it sounds like if you were writing a paper, maybe you would have your bibliography, your sort of your library in an index file. And then when you wanted to look up an author or a work, you could then query that index file with lookbib. That's the theory. In practice, I am finding that indexbib produces something that is not parsable by lookbib. So for instance, if I create a file called bib.grof and I make an entry .xp called blogs.josephr.i, everyone's a critic, and then Underground Press, March 2002, that this is a sample bibliography entry from the Grof manual. And I'll do a similar one under that. So I've got two entries in this Grof file that are citations. So now if I do indexbib and then point it at bib.grof, that produces, I think, an index file called bib.grof.i. Now if I do a cat of bib.grof.i, I get binary data. So, and if I run bib.grof.i, if I do a file on that, it tells me it's data. So in theory, I should be able to then run lookbib on the index that I've just created, because lkbib says that it searches bibliographic databases for references that contain the key, and prints any reference found on the standard output. So if I do lkbib and then dash p for the file, I need to define the file name. So I'll define it as bib.grof.i. And then I need to give it the key that I'm looking for. And I know that the person's name was Blogs. So I'll type that out as my key. Unfortunately, it tells me that the database bib.graph.i is a binary file, and I guess it can't be searched. However, I can use lkbib to search through my source file, the one that I didn't run through indexbib. So if I do lkbib-pbib.graph, just the source file of plain text, and look for blogs, then it successfully finds just the entry for blogs, not my second entry for Bogan, Franz Bogan. These are names from sample files. I'm only partly making some of them up, I think. It finds that entry, and it gives me the title of the book, and the publisher, and such, and the summary, and so on. So that does kind of work, just not exactly how I would have imagined it would work. And then if we look at lookbib, LOOKBIB, it appears to be an interactive prompt style application. So if I type in lookbib, LOOKBIB, and then we'll point it to bib.graph.i, tells me that's an error. There's no database found there. Take away the I, so now I'm pointing again at just the source file. Then I can tell it to search for blogs, for instance, and it returns the entry. So, and gives me a new lookbib prompt. So it's very interactive. Think about the Python, the idle prompt, that sort of thing. It kind of captures your cursor. You're typing into it. You're in this sort of mode of searching this file. I can't see myself ever using that one, certainly. That seems a little bit odd to me. I'm not sure why anyone would want to sort of get that deep into citations. But maybe that is a common thing. Maybe if you're writing something and you have 20 different authors and you need all the specifics, then maybe it is easier maybe to just stay in that prompt and you're just typing in the name of the author or the work and so on. So those are the bibliography commands. And I don't know if, I mean, the -p file name option should, or the -p option is followed by a file name from the man page says it should set that as the database. And I don't know if it's just not working and it really, really wants to look in the default location for its database, which apparently it does have. There's a default location somewhere on the file system. I checked. I don't have one. I don't know how it's supposed to get there because it's not in your home folder. It's like a system-wide thing. So it's all sort of a foreign world to me, to be honest. I'm not exactly sure what the intended workflow is there, or why the override doesn't appear to be working. That's all I'm going to say about index, look, and lookbib. The other option here is refer, which I know I'm skipping around here in the package. I'm not going by alphabetical necessarily, but topical works. So there's refer, and refer is part of the graph document formatting system. It copies the contents of a file name to the standard output, except the lines between a dot bracket and a dot bracket, so dot open bracket, dot close bracket, are interpreted as citations. Lines between dot R1 and dot R2 are interpreted as commands about how citations are to be processed. So this to me sounds like it's getting into the formatting of bibliographic entries in ways that I certainly wouldn't want to explore myself. I think I know that there are different formats for bibliographies. So, there's MLA and I don't know, AP style guide, IBM style guide. There's a bunch of different style guides out there. They all have apparently their own different way of formatting these things, so that I guess their audiences who are familiar with that style of notation kind of knows where to look, but that's getting into some detail that I don't care about yet. And if I ever start writing academic papers, then I guess I'll start to care. Possibly, I don't know. Maybe LaTeX or DocBook has a better way of managing that stuff anyway. Okay, so the next one alphabetically again is mmgraph, which is a preprocessor for graph. It is used for expanding cross-references in MM. So there's a front end to this macro for graph underscore MM. And once again, I think we'll just assume that that's some That's a macro set and a preprocessor that we would use it the same way that we would use EQN, Ken, and all the others, Lily Pond, and so on. Here's another, speaking of EQN, here's in EQN format equations for ASCII output. So in EQN is a shell script that invokes EQN with the ASCII output device, so that's dash capital T ASCII, and it simply ensures that your EQN equations are processed as text. So I don't think we need to go over that, and I really don't know enough about equations to know what proper formatting for that output would even look like. I mean, I guess it would have to be the same as EQN notation, but that's the way that you would want to process that in EQN. Okay, nROF. nROF is one of the originals. I mean, it's a ROF. So there was TROF and nROF, and then GNU-TROF, better known as PROF. If there is something that you know works only in nROF, then this is one of those things you would want to use the nROF script for. It's an emulation of nROF using GROF. It only works with ASCII, UTF-8, Latin 1, and CP 1047. So it's probably I'm imagining, I haven't done a whole lot of research into this, but I'm imagining that nROF was a little bit less featureful than GROF, and so sometimes for whatever reason you might need to dumb down GROF and use nROF for that. Now, I could be wrong, I might be slandering nROF, but I do feel like that's kind of been a thing. And even if that's not the case here, I think it's worth pondering for a moment how free software, I think, especially back in the 80s, yeah, and probably 90s and now, but definitely in the 80s, there really was an easy sort of, there was an inroad, because it was like the free software version of something could offer a bunch more options. And it was kind of a, for lack of a better term, that I know this gets overused and is almost too precise for computers right now, but it's a binary system in a way. Like, you open up your man page and you look if an option is available, and it's either available or it's not available. And I feel like at one point, you could do that on a Unix system, you know, copyright branded, trademarked Unix system, and you might find, oh, well, that option is not there. And then you might think to yourself, gosh, Janet over in accounting was just telling me the other day about this cool open source version of this command. I'm pretty sure she said it has this particular option, the foobar option. Let me check that out. And so you go get the open source version, and you open up the man page, and it's like two screenfuls instead of one screenful, because it has all these extra options that people have contributed back to the project. I gotta imagine that was an influence in the propagation of the free software versions of a bunch of the Unix stuff, because it was just kind of a night and day difference. And please, if you're someone who's used both and kind of have experience in this, I'd love to hear from you. But I'm just imagining a time where it was a very direct sort of competition. Sort of like there's this broken version, and there's this version with a bunch of cool new options that are, you know, too crazy for the conservative Unix company to let into their code. But the free software version has all of the options. And I mean, you can kind of emulate this in a way right now. If you go to a BSD system and you do a, you know, just pick whatever command you want, look at the man page and just look at how many options are not there or are different. And then go to the Linux system, look at the same command, and see what options aren't there or are different. And sometimes it is a case of, oh my gosh, there are so many more options here on this one and not on that one. Sometimes it's just that, oh, there's a real, just a complete, there's a smattering of both. They've clearly borrowed from each other. So, you know, and that's just because I think of a different lineage, a different code base, different versions of the same commands. People have different ideas. Obviously, BSD isn't closed and reserved like a corporate Unix would have been. It is just a different source. So you have the sort of a variation in what you end up having in the commands. So this is truly just an emulation of that experience. But if you want to do that, if you haven't done that, you should do that. You should literally do that because it is interesting and I think important to try a couple of different POSIX systems, because you can get locked into like, well, this is the only way to do this. This is the real version of grep right here. And then you go to a different system and you realize you're not dealing with that version of grep. And there's a completely valid other version with different options or different abilities. And you kind of need to get to know that. And if you don't need to get to know it, then at least you have to know how to adapt to it. That's a real skill. And I think it's an important one. It really is, because if you get really good on one system, like let's say Linux, you get really good at Linux, and then you get plopped in front of a BSD system or something, and suddenly you're at a loss. You just don't know what to do, because that one command that you need to run right now isn't working. And oh my gosh, how do you learn a new command again? What was that workflow? Like, how do we do that? It's a skill that you have to keep nurturing. So anyway, that's what NROF sort of made me think about. And it's not exactly the same, but I think it's related. I think there's something there. Okay, next command is pdfrof, and that creates PDF documents using grof. pdfrof is a wrapper program for grof. It transparently handles the mechanisms and multiple passes of grof processing when you're trying to turn something into a PDF. So once again, it's essentially a front end for grof dash capital T PDF, and it tries to handle things that would otherwise have to be manual options that you would put into, you know, you'd have to type that out yourself, and it tries to handle that for you. Okay, next is PFB to PS. This translates a PostScript font, which is a .pfb file, to ASCII, which as far as I know it's not saying it's going to take that font and turn it into ASCII. I mean, there's not really an ASCII font. I mean, there are ASCII fonts for terminals and stuff. But as far as I know, what it's saying is that it will take that PostScript font and translate it to PostScript, which of course you can view in an ASCII terminal. And this is, as I've said several times before, I don't know why you'd be doing this. I don't know why you would have such a font. I don't know why you would care about it. But if you did, that would be the program that you would want to look at. Let's talk a little bit about PIC, P-I-C. This is a big, big thing. I'm not going to belabor it because it can be a big topic, and I don't feel like it is something that is worth really dwelling on, but it's something to be aware of if you're going to use grof. So PIC is the formatting engine for including graphics in a grof document. You invoke PIC more often than you realize when you are using grof, because like if you're outputting to, well, for instance, a lily pond graphic, and you're outputting that to PDF, you're invoking PIC, because PIC is going to be the thing that draws that content box that you won't see, but that's it makes space in the grof document for that graphic. It makes sure that all those pixels get arranged in the right position as dictated by the lily pond format and so on. So it is you could think of it as a picture viewer embedded within a grof document, or rather a picture viewer embedded in the output of a grof document. Or you could just view it as a canvas, I guess. That would be the very, like if you're into web and even GUI programming, you might think of, okay, well, I know I have this canvas, I want to draw on it, and whether I'm talking to a macro saying, hey, load this PNG into that canvas space, into that area, or whether I'm actually issuing commands for pixels to be rendered. And so there's a language that you could use in PIC. So for instance, if you did a .ps request and then wrote something like circle at parentheses 1, comma 2, close parentheses, circle at parentheses 3, comma 4, close parentheses, box.pe, then when you run graph2pdf or graph2ps or whatever, then you'll see an illustration there, probably of two circles, I would imagine. So that's what PIC does, really, and the man page is definitely interesting, and it goes over sort of some of the syntax, and there's quite a lot of syntax. I mean, you've got fairly advanced drawing functions that you can invoke, you know, the sine and the cosine and the square root, a random integer between 1 and 0, or 0 and 1 rather, and so on. So there's, you know, there's a language there that you can embed into a pick request, and then you run that through the pick macro, and it does all the work that it needs to do in order to make that appear in whatever your output is. So that's pick. That was written, by the way, by, from what I can tell, Brian Kernighan. So it has a pretty nice pedigree, but it's not a language I intend to learn myself. Okay, next up is pick to graph. Convert a pick diagram into a cropped image. It reads the pick program as the input and then produces an image file, by default a PNG, from that input. So this is the same series of scripts as eqn2graph, crops2graph, and obviously this one pick2graph. So it's the same kind of translator. It'll take that input, it'll decode it, and it sends it out to ImageMagick specifically, and you can control how the output occurs with ImageMagick switches. So dash density 300 for a high-res image, or a, you know, somewhat high-res image, certainly higher res than the default of density 72 or 96 or 100 or whatever we're up to lately. The next commands are pretty easy because they explicitly say they're not meant to be called as a standalone binary, but that they are part of the graph pipeline to produce HTML output. Those are post-grow-html and pre-grow-html. So I'm not going to cover those because those aren't for us. Let's take a look at preconv. This converts a file into a format that Groff can understand. So for instance, it's a really super simple example here. But I open up a file called test.groff, and I paste in or type in using my fancy form character generator thing, compose key, I think is what it's called. But I type in a smiley face, which I hit compose key, colon, parentheses, I get a smiley face Unicode character. I'll save that and then run preconv on test.graph. And as my output, I get a backslash bracket U263A close bracket, which I assume is a valid Unicode Unicode code for a smiley face. That is preconv. Refer, we've already talked to. And then there's a bunch of little scripts here called Roth. To something, rough to DVI, rough to HTML, to PDF, to PS, to text, to X, and so on. Those are, as you can imagine, scripts to translate rough files into some other format. Rough code into PDF, rough code into DVI, and so on. Could you do it with Grapher? Yes, you could, usually. I'm not exactly sure what the selling point of these specific commands are. I don't know if they were things that people had gotten used to at some point, and when Groff came out, maybe it supplanted them, but wanted to make sort of that same workflow available. I'm just not sure. But it's these are yet again other ways to a very similar result. So elim, that's the name of a command. So elim does a it helps you source file, or rather process source files. So the normal processing sequence of Groff, and this is kind of what I was referring to, I think, in the previous episode, when I was commenting on how the workflow of Groff seems a little bit fragile sometimes, where it's like, well, if you run this preprocessor before you run this trough command, then you might run into problems and so on. And that can be problematic, I imagine. So elim makes that more flexible. The normal sequence would be your preprocessor, which would look at your input file, and it would pass the output onto trough or graph. And at that point, if you had a file that was being sourced into your graph document, that's when that would happen during that graph stage. And then it would maybe pass onto a post-processor if there was one, and it would do the output. With so elim, you can ingest, as it were, your input file and your sourced file all at once, combine them, send it over to the preprocessor, send it over to Groff, send it over to the postprocessor, and then you get your output file. An analogy to this, for me at least, would be that when I'm constructing a volume, in Doc Book, very often I compose different chapters in different as different files. Makes it a little bit more manageable, I think. But in order to process all of those files into a single file, I have to either concatenate them together or use xincludes, some other way of getting that text together. Now, if I use an xinclude, I have to include that xinclude namespace in my document. That's fine. But then I have to tell xsltproc, the thing that's going to process my XML and combine it with my style sheet, I have to tell it to process xincludes. Otherwise, it just sees a document with very little content, like 6 lines of xincludes. Now, of course, my intent is for each xinclude line to source a file such that I'm building this larger volume of text. But if xsltproc doesn't know to respect the xinclude commands, then it wouldn't do that. And that's kind of what soelim provides for graph. All right, formatting tables. This is a horrible, horrible process. Tables almost invariably just shouldn't be used. But Groff does have a system by which you can write tables. I can't tell you how much trouble tables have caused me in my life, so I highly recommend against them. If you're thinking about generating a table, think again. Seriously, think about it. Think about it carefully and ask yourself, can it be restructured as a list? Lists are much easier to render for different kinds of displays. I recommend it head and shoulders above a table. And in that spirit, I'm not going to give too much time to table formatter for Groff. But I will tell you, it opens up with a .ts, table start, I guess, .ts. It closes with a .te. And there's a bunch of different notation trying to help you format a table in plain text, which is a miserable, miserable experience, and you should spare yourself that pain by not doing it. Really, you should use something else. You should use a list. I know that there are exceptions to that, but they're fewer than you think. As someone who has converted many a table to lists quite effectively, I can vouch for this. The table macro does have, it is quite flexible. I mean, but then again, so is the markdown table format, and so is the HTML table format. I mean, they're all equally bad in the end. They render a table that no one knows how to render correctly. You either get the columns too thin or too wide, or you cut off part of the table, or you split the table across several pages and it stops to make sense. It's just, I realize that sometimes tables are a good analog calculator front end, but generally speaking, I urge you to reconsider. Okay, next up is tfm2dit, which creates a font file for use with Groff-TDVI. Once again, in real life, this is probably not necessary. You have so many fonts to choose from now. I don't see why you would have to go about converting fonts in this year, so I'm going to skip it. Hey, speaking of things to skip, there's X2Trough, which converts X font metrics into GNUTrough font metrics. Again, you shouldn't need to do this. This is not something that is, generally speaking, necessary. You can, if you want to, I don't know, rescue old font formats or something, but generally speaking, this just isn't necessary. And then finally, last, and certainly not least, I guess, but kind of least in a way, is Trough itself. This is not the non-free version of Trough. Obviously, this is still GNU Trough, but it's kind of the, I guess, apparently the actual processor portion of the Groff workflow. It's not intended to be used alone. It is generally meant to be used with Groff. So you should be executing Groff, which will do all the pre-processing and post-processing with Trough thrown in there when necessary. But this is nevertheless a separate binary on your system. If you look in USR bin, you'll see Groff and Trough are actually independent applications. But nevertheless, it says very clearly in the man page, it's not meant for you to run this on its own. You're meant to invoke Groff and let it run this Trough binary or invoke the Trough binary as appropriate. Given that information, I'm not going to obviously cover this because you'll just be using Groff. And it does seem like there's a lot of there are a lot of cases where that's kind of the situation where really ultimately you're not, you know, there's a lot of front ends and a lot of sort of preprocessors and things that you don't necessarily, you're not going to be really using yourself, and you'll just let Grof kind of magically take care of for you. And that's fine. Or you'll be running one of these aliases, but you'll know in the back of your mind that you're actually just invoking Grof with a couple of options that you didn't want to bother putting in yourself, which is fine. And that brings us to a close on the Grof overview. That's everything in Grof. I think, as I've said, it's a fascinating little system. I don't know that I'll use it ever, but it definitely seems a lot less scary now that I see the logic behind it. And frankly, you kind of can't argue with a toolchain as complete as this that just happens to be built into your system already. So check out Grof, maybe, I guess, or not. Depends on what you need in your word processing requirements. But it's fun. It's interesting. So give it a look. Or if you don't, don't be scared of it anymore. It's just another processor for text. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Podcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @Klaatu at mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, gnuworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time.
I just don't understand. I'm not even repeating the urban stuff. Why is it there any more?